Schizotopia. As always, I'm your host, Maxwell Cody, and joining me this evening, Lurushian operative, Sir Liam Murphy, Mr. Based Esquire. Is that good? Is that a good intro?
Sure, sure. All right. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast.
How's it going, man? How are you? We're going to talk politics tonight. So where should we start? I wanted to talk to you about, you told me that you work for or affiliated with the LaRouche movement. Well, why don't you tell me how you got involved in that?
Sure. Well, I've always been into politics since I was a young man. It's been quite the journey, but I really got into the infrared community.
How old are you now, Liam, real quick?
Well, I'm 23 years old.
All right. Well, you're still a young man. You're still in your journey. You're still in the first chapter.
Certainly,
okay, well, please,
certainly. Certainly. But I've been involved in politics since I was like 15. You know, I started getting into politics when I saw a certain man go down an escalator and say that he was going to make America great again. And I was like,
who was that?
Donald Trump.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. When I have a lot of family from the Midwest, and I've seen the state that the country is in, especially where it used to be so great. And I've always been called to politics because I just realized that having a normie lifestyle, going to work for 40 years, that's a dead end. You know, it's, the world is changing entirely. And to just sit on the sidelines during all of this change, it's not for me, bro.
All right. So why, but why the LaRouche movement in particular? What about them? You know, why didn't you just become a Democrat, an anarchist, an Antifa, an alt-right edgelord? Why LaRouche?
Well, Lyndon LaRouche had started actually as a communist, but then he had kind of evolved. I think that he was a very pragmatic person in the way that he delivered his perspective to different groups from different backgrounds. And the movement that he was trying to start up was not really, although he started, of course, as a communist, the movement that he started up was not really a left or right movement. It was a movement that was based on principles like the idea that all human beings are created in the image of God, and directly countering also a lot of the environmentalist attitudes of that humans are just by existing, they are a parasite and a drain on the environment. And Lyndon LaRouche, in a very unique way, he made clear that actually the human, the individual and the human creative power that only humans have, and in particular, our relationship with energy and science, that it's fundamentally different than any other animal, or any animal, I should say. And we have almost a metaphysical, geophysical role to play in shaping time, in shaping the Earth, in shaping the galaxy. You know, Vernadsky was the first person I'm aware of who really put this in a very scientific perspective. But, you know, humanity...
Hold on. Who is Vernadsky? Vladimir Vernadsky?
Vernadsky was a Russian-Ukrainian scientist. Mm-hmm. Who he's a biology guy. But he's really big into earth science. Some people credit him as actually being a proto-ecologist. But he came up with the term the biosphere. and then furthermore the neurosphere. And the idea is that humanity, humans and their impact, they have their geophysical force. We actually are unique as a species in being able to literally alter space and time and everything that surrounds us in a completely unique way. And this ties in with what the Bible, I come from a very Christian background as well too. And the very first commandment that God ever gives in the Bible is in Genesis 1:28, where he says, be fruitful and multiply, have dominion over the earth. And I didn't really think about that so much before I joined the LaRouche movement, although I did think about Christianity and stuff a lot, but I didn't realize that that was the very first commandment that was actually even in the Bible. And I think that's really interesting. And that, I think, is the goal of my politics and why I was attracted to when Trump said, make America great again. Well, what would make America great? And also, what makes being alive great? What makes our country's history great is that we used to build, we used to really make scientific progress. I mean, think of how much the world changed from 1900 to the 1950. You know, you unlock like a near infinite energy with nuclear when 50 years ago, you know, people are living without even electricity, essentially. And still to this day, and that's one of the things that I realize about empire and imperialism too, is that it's designed to shut down the creative impulse and leave people basically in the dark. And I kind of refer to my politics as a Promethean politics because, and this is why I wrote about Uganda. In Uganda right now, a large majority of people still do not have access to electricity. A lot of people in Africa today still use less energy than a refrigerator uses. You know, there's energy poverty in the world, and we have these vast technologies and even fossil fuels. Like if they could even develop a fossil fuel economy, that would be a complete shift in the balance of power and the chance for cooperation among nations. But if we also really incorporated nuclear technology and then even further with antimatter technology and with who knows what could happen even after that, we could completely eliminate scarcity.
Well, let me ask you this, Liam. When I think of the Old Testament, when I think of the Bible, the Old Testament specifically, and I think of, you know, yes, God's first commandment to man is be fruitful and multiply, have dominion over the earth. But after the fall from the garden, after the loss of paradise, you know, man tries to find his way back to God first by building a Tower of Babel. And God doesn't like this. And I've always saw the Tower of Babel as sort of being a refutation of that sort of Promethean myth that you find with the Greeks. So, I mean, I'd love to hear your take on this. How do you reconcile that Promethean impulse with what I would see as the more kind of anti-Prometheanism of, you know, the Tower of Babel or just kind of the general gist of the Old Testament?
Well, the Tower of Babel is a really perplexing story, and I've often asked about that too. You're right. The Tower of Babel as a story, you can interpret it in a anti-Promethean way. And it's interesting, you know, you do see a lot of people these days coming up with these things that sound almost near apostasy with these ideas of mankind through its technology and through development becoming on par with God. And I think you're right that the Tower of Babel may be a story that would express that kind of view, but maybe I'm not an Orthodox Christian in that sense. You know, there's a very interesting Russian, I'm forgetting his name, but he was the leader of what's called the Russian Cosmist School. He was an Orthodox Christian, and he's known for being a very pious monk. And he lived in the library, and he knew every single book within the library. And he believed that eventually through technology development, we would be able to resurrect all of the dead. Like it will happen, but he believes that we as a species through our technology will be able to do that. And we'll be able to colonize the stars. And that's how humanity, including all the dead saints, can all live together. And that is heaven. So he has this almost radical view that mankind will achieve the heaven that is supposed to basically just occur by fate in a typical Orthodox view of Christianity. And I think that Tower of Babel might be a refutation of that viewpoint, but I don't necessarily 100% buy into every story in the Bible being true or having a correct representation. But maybe we'll be smited by God if we try to get to Mars, but I hope not.
I only bring it up because, when you're talking about, from about 1900 to 1950, there's this huge unleashing of technological forces. I would point out that time in history also corresponded to world wars, revolutions, millions and millions and millions and millions of deaths, and then the prospect of nuclear annihilation, the thing, the weapon that looms over our heads even to this day. These powers that maybe were not meant for man, that we're not really mature enough to wield. And I always kind of saw the biblical view as being contrary to that. And if you go into the Apocrypha, like Book of Enoch, where, the fallen angels are the ones who are giving people all of this technology. The fallen angels are the ones who are, teaching people how to create bronze weapons and this sort of thing. And the people of God are supposed to eschew these things. And I think even in the Enochian version of Noah doesn't even build the ark. The angels build it for him. They like Noah because he doesn't engage in technology. So I've always seen that as a tension within biblical thought. And then I guess Greco-Western thought is, the Prometheus and Christ are kind of, or maybe more like Prometheus and Adam are sort of like on opposite sides of the spectrum.
No, I mean, I think you have I think that is honestly the battle of history, frankly, is this battle between kind of a force that is trying to restrain mankind because there is a belief that will be too big for our britches. But I'm of the opposite tendency. I think that we should empower man. And frankly, I think that I think the evil things that have come from the technological benefits, I think God means everything for good. I think we live in the best possible world, and whenever anything bad has happened to me in my life, I try and I look at it and think, how does this really fit into the context of history, and what lesson am I supposed to learn from this horrible thing? And I think the bad that comes from technology, or the bad that just comes from history, I think even without technology, you're going to have horrible things that happen. And I think that the evil is always meant for good and is a part of the wheel that moves history. You wouldn't have development, you wouldn't have progress without a kind of a war.
So my understanding is that LaRouche was raised, his parents hated communism and he was raised to be an anti-communist. And then sort of as a way of revolting against them, later he sort of gets involved with, I can't remember, I believe like Trotsky, he gets involved with some kind of Trotskyist sect. And he's a Trot for a while. And then after that, he sort of starts to combine sort of like Aristotle with Marx, and then this kind of very pro-American revolution kind of perspective. Anyway, he creates this very syncretic politics and works from there. And I've always thought of LaRouche, I always kind of see him as like a right-wing Maoist, if that makes any sense. But that's kind of how I see his syncretic politics. And also I remember him not being particularly kind to Russia, if I remember correctly. I don't think he actually liked the Russians very much. So I'm curious. I mean, where would you say you fall on the capitalism socialism perspective? What are your thoughts on China? How China is doing its version of socialism, quote unquote?
Well, it's important to note that I think when you saw LaRouche was writing against communism and he was writing against Russia, it was during the latter stages of the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, and all of these people that I think are complete sellouts of the vision that, Stalin had for the country. As it was, the secret speech. I'm a big fan of Stalin personally. One of my favorite books that I've ever read that I recommend to you and to all of your viewers is a book called Stalin's Library, A Dictator and His Books, because it gives you a real personal view of who Stalin was as a man and how much he would read and really think about the history of Russia, how he fit into that. And he was an intellectual through and through and a major inspiration for me. and a historically necessary character, and furthermore, a Promethean. And in fact, I think that that is really the tendency that he's attacked by, is because Stalin essentially said that, you know, we are progress, and we are going to move into a higher stage of production, whether people like that. And it's what happened with collectivization. As far as LaRouche, yeah, I don't think that, I think that LaRouche, this is just speculative theory. I don't know this at all. Maybe lots of people within the LaRouche organization would probably disagree with this. I think LaRouche was very pragmatic in the way he approached politics and the way he spoke, even though he's the movement is big on Gorgias by Plato and not trying not to use rhetoric. But I think LaRouche was very influenced by the John Birch Society, because you could see in the Blue Book by the John Birch Society, they talk a lot about the Aristotle-Plato dynamic. And they, around that time is when LaRouche also started to become an anti-communist. So I don't know. I think that's a tendency there. As far as me, I am very, I want efficient government. I think communism was a necessary reaction to the feudal society and the early stages of capitalism. And now, you know, the color red. Red is the color of communism. What does red in marketing and psychology stand for? It's like the libidinal color. It's like the color of sex. Yeah. It's the color of action. It's the color of rage. And I think now, today, that's the United States is basically that force. And that's why I think that the most, like you see Vaush and all these people call themselves communists and adorn the color red. And you have Antifa is like the strongest pro United States, like pro Biden, like people really, like they're the vanguard of this American system. I think it's because that's a, like a libidinal outpouring, and they just want to destroy all of that's open society. They just want to cut down any tradition, cut down any relationship to meaning, any relationship to truth. And I think nowadays, as we've seen from China, what's more important than a libidinal outpouring is actually trying to create a system of governance that actually aligns the interests of individuals, corporations, society as a whole toward what is beneficial and productive for everyone. We all need food. We all need shelter. We all need real quality education to where we could actually think for ourselves and think independently. I mean, there's no such thing as really thinking independently, but as thinking critically, I guess I should say, and knowing what it really means to know something. I mean, nowadays, a lot of people are becoming flat earthers. And I could understand it. And in fact, when I was younger, I was a flat earther, because in school, they essentially just tell you, oh, the earth is round. And they show you photos of the planet. And they say, oh, look, it's round. And they do like, they put all these debunk videos at the top of YouTube whenever you type in flat earth that just say, flat earth debunked. It's so stupid. So people, but the thing is, if you ask the average person, the average high school graduate, is the earth round? They're going to say it's round. And then you say, okay, what are you like? What does it, how can you prove that to me? Can you prove that to me that the earth is round? And they can't do it, but it's been proven over and over. Like people are, you're able to measure, like people are not taught how to really learn and how to really know something. They're just taught to regurgitate.
Yeah, there's a difference between science as an institution and science as a methodology. And now, you know, when you hear people talk about believe science, believe science, believe science, and you say, well, what does that actually mean, believe science? Science shouldn't require belief, right? Science is supposed to be a methodology. The scientific method shouldn't require any belief whatsoever. And usually when people are saying believe science, they're saying believe in science, the institution. Well, the problem with that is that science inevitably makes mistakes. That's what makes it science. And then people start to become disillusioned with science, the institution, and then it starts to become, well, if they were wrong about this or wrong about that, maybe they're not just wrong, maybe they're lying to us. If they're lying to us, maybe we live in crazy upside down world where you've been told the earth is round, well, now it must be flat, this sort of thing. And there's like a kind of knee-jerk contrarianism in there that I think is kind of immature, but it's sort of the flip side of the libidinal economy, right? There's sort of like if you live in a libidinal economy, you live in this, like you talked about, this outpouring of erotic technological power, for lack of a better term, there's maybe a part of you that wants to there's a part of our collective psyche that starts to regress back to childhood and starts to become very childish and contrarian in this way. And I think you see a lot of that on the internet every day.
Sure. Certainly, and look at I'm sorry, but look at dog coins are the greatest example of this, and people just laugh this shit off. They laugh off the GameStop situation. They laugh off the dog coin situation.
Do you mean Dogecoin?
Yeah, but it's not limited to just Dogecoin itself. There's all these different dog coins and cat coin, okay, and all these different shit coins.
Pee pee poo poo coins, yeah. every pee pee poo coin you can imagine.
It as an ironic. Yeah, but the thing is, what is it that people are investing in? They're investing in. They believe that this meme, which is a meme, is basically a libidinal force. They're saying that this libidinal force, this meme, is going to grow and expand. And I don't think there's ever been, there's been speculation throughout all of history, but speculation essentially just on something becoming a meme or just a libidinal force. We're completely controlled by that libidinal urge, and you could see it with this resurrection of dog coins. But as a if you consider yourself a Marxist, I partially consider myself a Marxist, I think that we should be talking more about what does that mean for value, how we actually evaluate something. I think a lot of people are just shutting off, oh, that's a horrible thing, that it's the ultimate layer of speculation. But I think that there's maybe some sort of interesting potential here, now that we've gotten money to really truly even boil down to a signifier of libidinal energy and force. Maybe you could say it's always been that, but now it's very primally that. This creates a very interesting opportunity, and the fact that all the banks are collapsing and we're getting closer and closer as they get bought out to just basically having one thing, and that thing also expresses just this pure libidinal energy. I don't know what to make of it. Maybe you have something to say about it.
what I'm a little confused by is you're talking about how capitalism in the West has alienated us from nature, alienated us from truth. It sort of dumbed us down. It's unleashed all of these irrational forces that are keeping us from truth, so to speak. But you're also telling me that you admire Stalin. And when I think of Stalin or Marxist-Leninism in general, I think of, really, to me, that's just capitalism on speed mode. That's just doing the same thing at an accelerated pace, because you don't have the pretense of liberalism going and civilizing, external peoples that you're colonizing or taking over the course of a few centuries. With Marxist-Leninism, at least how it's actually existed in the world, you turn all of that, you turn that kind of ideological, you turn that ideology of progress inward and, force the society, sans liberalism, to create an industrialized nation state as quickly as possible, even at the cost of human life and even at the cost of natural resources. I mean, the Soviet Union did not have a great relationship with nature. And I don't think really China, in the way that it's developed, has had a particularly great relationship with nature either.
Well, I want to push back on that if I can, actually. And this is an important point. A lot of people have weird conspiracy theories that the LaRouche movement is funded by fossil fuel lobbying or something like that, mm-hmm, because they've pushed back so hard against environmentalism. And everyone thinks that pushing back on environmentalism somehow means that you're being sponsored by Big Oil. What they don't realize is that Big Oil is basically the biggest sponsor of environmentalism. But if you look at, I think that the Greens within the West have completely shifted what it really means to be in tune or in harmony with nature. Because to them, really, humanity can't be in tune or in harmony with nature unless we just succumb to it and die. And that's very clear in the way that they view overpopulation to be a serious problem. They view us as an expenditure on the earth rather than the creative essence and the creative force of the earth. And I would say that when you look at Stalin, actually, Stalin actually made a lot of environmental protections. Dairy consumption from 1928, when collectivization began, to 1937 at the start of World War II, the dairy consumption within Soviet Russia more than tripled. The agricultural yields of basically everything tripled. But meat consumption actually went down. Now, I'm not a fan of that. I like meat. But one of the reasons why meat went down is because during the Tsarist era, there was kind of an open field for, you know, killing wildlife. And during the Stalinist era, they passed a lot of wildlife and restrictions in order, not because they just wanted to save the animals, although that was a part of it for a certain, you know, a certain respect for nature, but also furthermore, because they viewed it as a part of their national strength to have a healthy environment. And I think these leftists have created this, you know, these Western leftists, they've created like this idea that progress must come at the cost of harmony with nature, but true progress would be in harmony with nature. And for he to not have it on the world would actually be us being in disharmony with nature. I could talk more about that, but I feel like I've been rambling a lot during this podcast.
No, so it's fine. I'm not understanding, you know, why it is that the capitalist mode of production is so deeply alienating from nature, but like the Stalinist or Marxist-Leninist model is somehow better. And then I'm confused about how that relates to, you know, man being the image of God. Do you see what I'm saying? This like kind of Christo-Stalinist position that you have is a little peculiar, right?
Well, look, when you are transforming, I mean, the Great Man-Made River Project, this is what was done in Libya under Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. This completely transformed the environment of Libya. It made, you know, arid desert into some of the most fertile land in the world. And this is a good thing for the environment. And it took a ton of fossil fuels to do it. It takes a ton of energy to do that. Energy is basically a measure of complexity. And mankind is uniquely the only living being that could actually increase energy flux density by choice through creative and scientific discoveries and developments in the mode of production. Like the correlative increases of our population, everyone has seen the graph, the Industrial Revolution. Once we discover steam power and we start to further our Promethean advantage with fire, and fusion is the ultimate, will be the ultimate push through with that, because then we literally have direct control over shaping atoms. Mm. In fact, with fusion power, it's very feasible that a kind of Star Trek replicator type technology can be developed, which is also coincident with basically the philosopher's stone, the idea that you could transform lead into gold, or we could do that with fusion. You could transform basically any type of molecules into another isotope. So you could take trash, and through the fusion process, you would actually be able to turn that trash into another material. Now, for now, under our current, we can't really do it. It would cost trillions of dollars to basically make an ounce of gold, but it is theoretically possible. And that would be, I mean, this idea that us using our minds, which is a part of nature, to make development is somehow harmful to nature is the most
harmful. Sure, not harmful in theory, but in practice, if you're looking at the last couple centuries, the world has gotten more technologically sophisticated. Yes. And you know, where countries have industrialized, life expectancy goes up, all these sorts of things, but it's also corresponded to a massive despoiling of the planet. It's also corresponded with despoiling of the planet. I mean, you don't deny that the way things are, we're polluting the planet. We've lost a lot of old forests, polluted a lot of water, a lot of rivers, destroyed a lot of wildlife. I mean, I don't even want to get into global warming. I mean, you could just you could just ignore global warming entirely and we're still fucking up the planet.
I think that we should not ignore those problems at all, at all. I think that the fundamental solution to those problems will be to apply our creative thinking in our developmental approach to figure out how to best address those problems. And frankly, that's already been done a lot since the 60s, since the 50s and 60s. There's been tons of changes, and switching to nuclear, of course, will be a big part of that, you know? And
well, let me ask you about this.
Is
there a LaRouchean view on something like AI?
There might be a LaRouchean view. There's also my individual view that I don't want to I'm not speaking for that organization because they have, maybe we might have different parts. I mean, most of the people in the organization are really much older, and you're allowed to have your own opinion. So, but what was the question?
Just AI. I mean, do you see AI as a mark of progress? Do you see that as something that's going to be able to solve our problems in the future? I mean, because I think AI would kind of highlight a lot of the things that we're talking about. Because for me, my fear is that, you know, there's no reason to think that an advanced AI would also be rational in a way that we would define it, that it would necessarily have our best interests at heart, assuming that you could create an actual true AI, not just something that was mimicking us. This sort of thing, right? Where right now you see a lot of people with a ton of optimism about AI and a lot of energy that's being poured into creating AI. And this belief is kind of enlightenment, dare I say Promethean belief, that AI is going to solve our problems. It's going to be this new frontier. It's going to be this great fulfillment of all our scientific dreams.
The United States, it's a very political thing, AI is, and high computing power. This is the hill that the United States believes it can die on right now. And so they are pushing the idea that AI is going to be all powerful. It's going to fundamentally change everything because they believe that they could win the war against China without firing a bullet, because we could defeat them by developing ourselves so much by investing in the AI. And I think it is the last dying grasp of an empire. AI is going to be a helpful tool. Who knows how it would develop and grow, but I think that the idea that it's going to be some sort of superpower is fundamentally an idea that is promoted to try and encourage a sort of AI weapons arms race. And I mean, it's clear that that's what's happening, because just recently the United States has passed these sanctions that are prohibiting Chinese development of AI and Chinese development of things that you would need for higher level computing. And I think that this is greatly exaggerated, the power of these things. I use ChatGPT all the time. I really enjoy it. I think it's a useful tool. It's a helpful research tool. It will probably make some jobs a lot easier and possibly even replace them. I know that in some instances it's already done that. We should develop AI as much as we can. Now, I do think it is, as a technology, it is a technology that tends to dystopian use cases. Like, I think the biggest thing to be scared of, for instance, is a completely automated surveillance system in which you could, but I'm not sure to how much that is pretty much already developed and is already, you know, laying in wait for us. I'm not as much of a doomer about it as a lot of other people. What is your take on AI?
My general view of AI right now is just like everything else, like every other big technological boom we've had over the last 100, 200 years. Actually, I don't want to take that big of a scope. If you look at everything that we've gotten excited about over the last 25 or even 50 years, something like that, take the internet itself. Okay. Obviously, the internet had a lot of positive things about it, and clearly it exceeded a lot of people's expectations. However, the internet now, I would say, is collectively driving us insane. It's had a lot of negative social consequences. And now, on top of that, you're going to have basically these ape machines, these mimicking machines, these things that can look and talk and act like human beings on the internet. but aren't and don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. I mean, for me, it's kind of demonic. It's the opposite of Promethean. Instead of it being us ascending to heaven through technology, I feel like we're being pulled down into a more primitive state, into a more primitive consciousness. And that in many ways, people who lived 100, 200 years ago were actually much more sophisticated and advanced than what we are today. And
I totally agree. I don't think that progress is linear. I do believe in progress, but I don't think that it's necessarily linear. And I don't really think that AI is really a technological breakthrough. This is, I guess, a little schizo, but I think that AI has existed many times before, something like it. And this is really nothing new. You know, the internet is basically
many towers of Babel. Sure.
It's just a rehash of a appendix, really.
It just Prometheans seem to forget. Prometheus had to pay for stealing fire from the gods. He got his liver eaten out for the rest of time. There was a price that somebody had to pay for us to have fire.
It's very true. But, you know, I do think that out of the AI, there is a unique possibility here because, for instance, the Reddit normie who is scared of AI because he thinks that it's smarter than him, it's because he talks to the ChatGPT and it's way more interesting than most of his Reddit friends, because we've been taught in school, and we talked about this earlier, to basically think that to have knowledge means, or to really have wisdom means to just have a lot of facts and have access to be able to really pull them up in your head super quickly. People think that being smart means winning a trivia game. And of course, an AI is way better at that than we are, because it has access to trillions and trillions of archives that it could just instantly pull up that we couldn't possibly ever read through in a lifetime. But this creates a unique opportunity for us, because we could say, wait a minute, now that we realize that this is the case, what does it actually mean to have intelligence? What does it actually mean to have knowledge? What does it actually mean to have progress? What does it actually mean to really know things? What does it mean to be a good writer? You see, all of these really angry leftists, like all furries and stuff, are saying AI is the instant they were doing. If you look at a classical painting or a classical sculpture, the AI can't, like, the emotion, the insight that is in it, the real, like, human nature that is within it, it's not recreatable by an AI, because AIs can't create insight.
We've put a huge emphasis on quantification, and that is something that AI is going to excel at, is quantification. It's not going to be able to qualify things. Sure, but I would just say, you know, I'm not afraid of a mountain lion because I think the mountain lion is smarter than me. I'm afraid of the mountain lion because it's more powerful than me. And actually, I'm afraid of it because in a lot of ways, it's dumber than me. It can't be reasoned with. I can't just ask it to leave. I can't tell it. I'm not walking down your trail because I mean you any harm, right? I'm afraid of it precisely because it is both stronger than me and dumber than me. Right. So it's the same thing with AI. I mean, you know, AI already is becoming predatorial. People are using it to scam people. And I imagine that's only going to get worse. But hopefully maybe you see what I'm struggling with here. It just seems, with the LaRouche people especially, it just seems that you have this very syncretic politics that is kind of hard to lock down on what exactly it is. Because you've talked about, you know, being influenced by both Christianity and Stalin. You've talked about humanism from like a biblical perspective. And then you've also talked about, I would say, humanism from kind of like a Greco-Western Promethean perspective. And I see a lot of tension between all of these things. And I've always noticed with like the LaRouche movement, it's such a mixed bag that it's hard to know what the actual platform is. And then you've even
it's a mixed bag, but it's also... it's also my own mixed bag.
Sure.
They don't like to talk about communism. They would just, if you talk to an older LaRouche person, they would not say anything about communism. They don't really like Stalin. It's me. But I would say that I think that truth always lies in complexity. When you find contradictions, or when you you learn the most from going to the most extreme sides and trying to synthesize them, my opinion. And I think true knowledge is in synthesis. So I would like to synthesize Ayn Rand with communism. I'd like to.
How's that going? Okay. All right. Well, now we're getting somewhere. How might one synthesize Ayn Rand with communism?
Just how could
that
you
is a tall
read,
order. That
how
is a
could
tall
you
order.
Even read the novel Anthem? See, this is, I don't even think that, maybe I'm wrong by trying to talk about things and synthesize them and use this language, because maybe it is confusing to people. Because
Anthem,
I don't agree in casting things into these kind of categories, of categories of like knowledge or categories of things, because I think in the end, we're all, whether we're Muslim, whether we're Christian, whether we're atheist, we all want and benefit from the same basic things. And we all know, we would all know if we actually had it and saw it, what effective governance looks like. We all know what we all have access to what truth really is. We all have access to beauty. We could see something beautiful. People can delude themselves and lie and say they don't think it's beautiful, but we all know beauty when we see it. We all know truth. And so that is what I'm after. I'm not after communism. I'm not after any of these things, but I think that God has a plan for us, and everything that has ever happened is a part of that plan. And so everything we should study, we shouldn't say, oh, we can't read Ayn Rand because we're Marxists, or, oh, we can't read this or think about this because of that. Oh, we can't have these opinions. I, for instance, when I was a young man, I'm still young, but when I was younger, I read all of Nietzsche's books, and he challenged me a lot because I grew up in a very Christian environment. But when I read his critique of Christianity, it was scathing, and it really challenged me in my beliefs and my views. But I think it made me a stronger Christian. My parents don't really necessarily think that I'm a Christian, but I know I am ascending to truth.
You,
and that's
okay.
what it's all about.
But you agree that there's a conflict between Nietzsche and Christianity.
There's a conflict, as in their antagonistic forces, as in, of course,
yes.
He wrote a book called The Antichrist.
Yes.
And he talked about how his views on Christianity, how he thinks it's horrible, essentially, and that it elevates the weak and kills the strong. And I thought that there's some real truth in a way in that. It's going to sound paradoxical, but I think that everything that everyone says, at least everything that everyone says that they truly believe, has a layer of truth to it.
Okay. But for there to be a dialectic, for there to be any kind of progress, you're going to have opposing forces. I mean, you're saying that through Nietzsche, you became a stronger Christian in a way. Right. But that's kind of my point. You didn't end up taking Nietzsche's side. You just saw Nietzsche as a way of understanding Christianity in a new way.
Well, for a while I did. You know, for a while I actually was like, you know, he's completely right. And it completely changed my life. And
was this pre or post flat earther phase?
It was post. I mean, no, pre flat earther phase, but.
So you became a Nietzschean then? It was Nietzschean to flat earther pipeline?
That is probably a real pipeline, I would imagine. Do you think that's
that'd be
a
new
real
one to
pipeline?
Me. That would be a new one to me. The will to flat earth, I don't know. That would be a new one to me. That feels like feels very zoomer. That feels very zoomer to me. And then,
how old are you?
I'm 35.
Okay.
Okay, when I was 16, 17 years old, I was running around talking to LaRouche people too. So I'm somewhat familiar with that movement. But what I wanted to ask you about is, well, two things. One, so grew up Christian, had a Nietzschean phase, had a flat earther phase. What happened after that?
I have always been the same person. Whether I don't believe I've ever been in phases. I am.
Liam, if you tell me, if I'm just saying, if you tell me you grew up Christian and you believed in Christianity and then you 100% agreed with Nietzsche, that would be a repudiation of Christianity. If you believe that the earth was round at one point and then you believed it was flat, I mean, these are changes in views.
Well, remember what you said about science?
Mm-hmm.
As you learn more and as you think things through, And as you apply your experience and reason to things, and you look at it from different views, your view ends up developing. I told you about that book by Stalin. Yes. Stalin grew up in a clerical environment, but he was one of the biggest persecutors of the church ever, but then he brought the church back. You know, people, things are much more complicated than just putting things in categories. And you'll often find, like, for instance, people have often seen that fascism and communism share similarities. And I think it's just absurd when people try and cast things into boxes and categories instead of really trying to pay attention to what is happening in the physical realm and how these forces actually interplay with one another.
Right. But in order to be able to function or be able to think about anything, we're going to have to categorize a little bit, and we're going to have to make distinctions, and we're going to have to outline conflicts and so on and so forth. Right. Like if I ask you for directions to the store and you start telling me like, yeah, well, but all streets ultimately connect. And, you know, we call this West Street and we call this East Street. But what does that really mean? Because, you know what I mean? Like that would be insufferable. Right. You wouldn't be able to give anybody directions to go anywhere.
Yeah. You need a common heuristic reference point. I mean, if we don't agree on what's left and what's right, then we won't be able to have a conversation.
But right. So A, B, and C, I'm making distinctions between A, B, and C. Even if by the time we get to Z, we realize the whole alphabet is just one great letter. That's fine. But in order to be able to talk about anything, we have to be able to talk about A, B, and C. Now, if you're telling me you grew up Christian, then you got really into like Nietzsche anti-Christian views. You know, you grew up believing the world was round and you went through a phase where you were a flat earther. And then I'm assuming you've come out of that now, right? As you've said. I'm just wondering, it's like, where does LaRouche movement come in? This has to be after Flat Earth, right?
Well, I think that you're right. And I hope that I don't sound too just crazy or something, in that I'm not grounded in anything. But what I believe that you do need a heuristic, and that's what people are after when they go after a religion. Even though, depending on who's asking me, I might call myself a Christian, and Christianity informs my view and informs my outlook, and the experiences I've had with Christianity informs my outlook. It's not like I just see the world through this box that we could both call Christianity, because there's a million different sects of Christianity, and everyone's view, even within those sects, is their own. That's informed from every other part of their life and experience that they've ever lived.
Yeah, Liam, I'm just trying to figure out how you got involved with the LaRouche movement. I'm just trying to understand the progression here. That's all.
Okay. So I got into infrared, the infrared movement, because I was working for some Democrats. And I was,
hold on. What is the infrared movement? What is the infrared movement?
So the infrared movement is the originator. The infrared, it's named that because it's beyond the visible spectrum. In the West, there's a lot of these leftists and communists, but I think that they've really been bastardized, especially since the 60s, by this kind of Congress for Cultural Freedom, anti-Soviet, anti-communist communism. Within the West, they're all about this LGBT things. And it's libidinal. I think it's just this little force rather than actual scientific force. Marxism is supposed to be at science. So the infrared movement was really pushing back against this kind of libidinal, sexual, revolutionary Marxism that we see as the so-called progressive left in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I had always considered myself, even when I was supporting Trump, when I was a younger man, I had always considered myself more of a socialist. I liked Bernie Sanders as well, too, at the same time I liked Trump, because I've always thought that everyone should have access to food, everyone should have access to housing, healthcare, and that would make the economy most productive if we had those things too. And so the infrared movement, you know, they were socialists, but they were also not falling into this like, oh, America is Turtle Island and we need to sacrifice for the Native Americans and white people should be kicked off of their land, you know, type bullshit. And I recommend people listen to Haas, listen to Infrared. It's very fun. But I also, through Infrared, I found the Center for Political Innovation, which is Caleb Maupin, who shares a similar type of tendency. And he interviewed Daniel Burke, who is a LaRouche. And I really liked a lot of the things that Daniel Burke was saying in his interview with Caleb, and the way he was kind of framing things and thinking about it. And I started to read some of the books by Lyndon LaRouche, and it was very insightful. So I was invited to help out on Diane Sayre's campaign, who is a senatorial candidate in New York for the LaRouche movement. I helped out in the campaign, and I have been helping out with the movement, and I live in the area now. I moved out over here into New York, and that's how I got involved.
Was there any epiphany moment where you thought, okay, LaRouche saw what other men could not see, something like that, where you were like, this is, I'm going to support this movement above every other movement for this specific reason?
Well, I really liked the way that they made it even more concrete, the relationship between history, production, physical economy, in the Leibnizian sense, and especially in the relationship to energy. I was into politics for a long time, but I never really had considered how important energy is, and how important energy is spiritually, metaphysically, how it's really the foundational block of economy as well too. And it offered a unique heuristical framework for speculating and thinking about history, thinking about development, thinking about humanity's role within it. And I mean, they've often been charged by Marxists of being idealists because of their thoughts about the individual and this individual human creative ability and mind in the role of progress and of history. But the way that they've developed that approach, I think, makes a lot of sense and is very interesting.
So you told me you've written a few articles for this this LaRouche publication, Executive Intelligence Review. Can you tell me about the Executive Intelligence Review?
Sure. You could go and subscribe to it. I have a special discount if anyone is interested. But the Executive Intelligence Review has been writing news briefings. They've taken a very anti-imperialist stance for the last, I think it's been maybe even 50 years now. It was started, I think, in the 70s. And they've been ahead of so many things, doing great journalism, giving great updates. And the thing that I really love about them too is that they don't just focus on politics in itself, but also on science. They've done great work on developments in nuclear energy, developments in all sorts of other fields. And there's a couple of members of the LaRouche organization who are real trained, scientists who have done scientific research themselves and methodology. And you could ask them questions about so many given topics. And for instance, recently I've been learning about a phenomena called sonoluminescence, which is something I had never heard of before and is extremely interesting. You could actually produce with sound light by passing sound at a certain frequency through water and forming this bubble that explodes. And even though it's right here in front of you, it within the molecule, it's three times this. It's a temperature fusion, and a spark of light is created as well too. And no one understands this phenomenon yet. It was discovered in 1939, and it's a very easily repeatable phenomenon. You could do it with very little money. You could create the conditions to create such an effect. There's really not been a use or a developed use of this phenomenology yet that we can. We haven't learned anything that is useful for creating a product or for. There's speculations that perhaps it could be used for fusion, but we haven't really studied it. And it's I would really, the LaRouche movement has really encouraged me to really read more and read classical literature, and especially the works of science, Johannes Kepler. We went through Gauss's fundamental theorem of algebra. And because being educated in the United States, I really have never done scientific and productive work like that. And I can't really explain everyday scientific phenomena, but the LaRouche movement has kind of empowered me to try and push that way and develop myself educationally in that regard. And I think that that is a model that should be extended throughout the nation. You know, people should know physics, they should know science in an applicable way, but where they can really understand how to make fundamental developments.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to college, Liam?
Yep. Indeed, I did. Studied political science for 4 years, got my bachelor's.
Oh, perfect. And now you're just kind of doing independent study with LaRouche movement.
Yep. Exactly.
You told me that you wrote some articles for Executive Intelligence Review. Can you tell me about those articles?
Yes, I wrote an article titled Prometheus. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was about African development in Uganda. They're building the world's largest heated crude oil pipeline under President Museveni, who is extremely based, really great guy. But he's been attacked recently, and the Obama administration went after him. The Biden administration is going after him right now, and they're really trying to depose of him because they're using the excuse that he signed some sort of anti-LGBT bill recently. But reality is, he's very open to working with China and working on the Belt and Road Initiative and the East African Crude Oil Project is indeed a Belt and Road project. CNOOC, the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company, is a major stakeholder as well as a French company. And while the French company is a bigger investor, they haven't been as personally involved. For instance, China has coordinated and deeply worked with Kampala University, which is a Ugandan, basically the biggest university in Uganda. And they have a student exchange program with China, and they developed a geological society, which is training young Ugandans to be geoengineers and understand the fossil fuel industry, as well as they're really working on the groundworks right now for the development of a nuclear industry. And you could just compare and contrast that with what the West has done with Uganda. And we've had paid hundreds of millions, sometimes even billions of dollars to all these NGOs to basically protest them even building dams, building hydroelectricity plants, and trying to stop them from building that using these environmental groups. And it's a type of green imperialism. And that is what I wrote about in my article. And then my other article was basically an extension of that, but it was a transcript from a talk I gave.
Okay. How do you feel about Belt and Road? How do you feel about China?
I think that they're the model for the world right now. They're doing, I mean, not in every single way. You know, countries should be free to decide how they domestically orient themselves. But as far as the relationship that they have with other countries, with their foreign policy, Xi Jinping's governance of China is an absolute must read. Everyone must read it. You don't have to read everything in it, but you should definitely comb through it and see the kinds of, you know, you wouldn't see Joe Biden writing something like this and giving these kinds of talks. They are.
You wouldn't see Trump doing that either, though, right?
Not in such an eloquent manner. No, Trump is his own guy.
Well, would you say the LaRouche movement today like has a pretty pro-China position?
Oh, certainly. And they've always been extremely pro-China since the reform and opening up period. And that was one thing I forgot to mention earlier, that as soon as the Soviet Union, LaRouche was a deep collaborator with Russians even during the days of the Soviet Union. And today, the most influential social club in Russia, the Cosmos, the Modern Cosmos Club, and what's his name? I'm forgetting his name, which is bad because what I'm saying is basically pointless. But he's a huge name, and he's a very close advisor to Putin. Actually, just said that Lyndon LaRouche was the most impactful economist of the past and philosopher of the past like century.
I'm sorry, drop that a little bit. Who said that?
His name is escaping me right now.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which is, but I will try and after this, I'll share it with you. It's because they have these Russians, man. Their names are Svoyev, but like, oh, you know, I forget all their names.
A little bit hard to remember sometimes.
But also, they proposed once the Soviet Union collapsed, that is when they actually began proposing this World Land Bridge project, which and this new Silk Road. And that's essentially what the One Belt, One Road policy developed into, is precisely what Lyndon LaRouche was laying out. And that's been kind of the model that's been followed. I'm not saying that there's like a one-to-one that they're doing it because of Lyndon LaRouche, but he did go into these countries and was very influential. People don't realize, you know, there's a verse in the Bible that says a prophet is never accepted in their own country.
Mm-hmm.
Or in their own, you know, whatever. But I think that that's very much the case with LaRouche, because he's actually not incredibly popular in the United States, and his name is just associated with cult behavior and whatever. But around the world, he's very much so revered, and he's a very influential statesman around the world. I mean, a lot of the development plans. There is a plan to refill Lake Chad in Africa that the Schiller Institute developed and laid out. And now it's actually, there's been millions of dollars spent in research and development on the feasibility of this project by a Chinese company that was actually the same company to get the contract to build the Three Gorges Dam in China. And they're considering actually doing this project that the Schiller Institute presented in Lake, for refilling Lake Chad. So pretty phenomenal, actually. And I guess that answers a question you asked me earlier too. The level of creativity that the LaRouche movement has had over the years in constantly developing ideas and actually being successful in proposing them to foreign leaders around the world for development projects. It's a kind of creative and fun vision that you just don't get from literally anyone else except Trump. You know, Trump recently with his proposal for a quantum leap in these freedom cities is quite exciting, but he doesn't, you know, he didn't go in detail on any of that at all. And he doesn't really have a plan for that. It's just kind of like,
I'm sorry, freedom cities. I think I've missed this.
Oh, you didn't hear about this. So Trump proposed that the United States needs a quantum leap. It's Agenda 47. And he thinks that we need to build 10 new cities in the United States, each one being a new special development zone that could be focused on the development of certain technologies or certain industries. He kind of funnily, it was kind of like a meme, he said that we're going to develop flying cars, you know, flying cars.
Well, this sounds kind of LaRouchean, but I don't understand, why would we need 10 new cities when we could just, I don't know, try to reinvest, reinvigorate some of our existing cities, like maybe, you know, in the Rust Belt or something like that.
Well, I mean, you could take it up with Trump.
We're just going to give up on Detroit. We're just giving up. We're just building another. We're just building Detroit too. we're done with Detroit.
Well, you know, China's actually successfully modeled this a couple of times, where they've had cities and then they built a city about, you know, 10 or 15 miles away. This was what the whole ghost city phenomena was. People were criticizing China for having these great big ghost cities. But what they ended up doing with a lot of those ghost cities is they built them first before there was anyone there. And then they got filled up, and now they're filled with all these people and they're booming and bustling. And if you look at like some of these cities, they're so dilapidated, man, it might be a better idea to, with Detroit, you know, build another city about 10 miles away or something like that and just start anew.
Trump announces Detroit too. Okay. So I'm guessing in 2024, you're going to be supporting Donnie.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. There's a lot of candidates that are exciting. RFK has some potential. Tulsi Gabbard would be definitely interesting. So far, Trump is my favorite. The LaRouche people, the older LaRouche people absolutely hate and despise him. But I'm interested in the Kanye West campaign. I think that might be fun. That might be interesting. And I don't know if you really want to get into that at all. Probably not. But you know,
Well,
Trump is, I think, definitely the most potential.
I think Kanye is bipolar, and I think he's probably coming down off his mania now. And I don't know if he's going to have enough energy to actually run for president, would be my take. But what's the vibe in the LaRouche movement itself? Are people mostly pro Trump there? I can't imagine there's a lot of pro Biden people.
Well, definitely no one is pro Biden.
Okay.
There was a split within the LaRouche movement a couple of years ago that I don't really know all that much about, but there's the LaRouche pack and there's the LaRouche like organization. Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is obviously Lyndon LaRouche's husband, she's in the Schiller Institute and the LaRouche organization. She's attached to that. The LaRouche pack people, they are very explicitly extremely pro-Trump, and that's like their biggest thing. They basically have turned into kind of just Trump people, like Trump people informed
MAGA LaRouche. Yeah,
they're like MAGA LaRouche. That's a good way of saying it. While the LaRouche organization, the Schiller Institute, they take on a much more really considering foreign policy and really considering, you know, how do we get along with other nations and work together with them and proposing more. They're not really as interested in domestic things, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Are there any QAnon fans in the LaRouche movement or any former QAnon people in the LaRouche movement?
No, the LaRouche people are way too smart to fall for that psyop. And furthermore, the LaRouche people are, even though they're labeled as a cult, they're very, very big on not just, they're very against sense certainty and just randomly believing things. Like, you know, they're not into like conspiracy, even though that's like the thing that they're charged for the most,
mm-hmm.
you know? So they hate QAnon, and they're really, that's one of the major things that they've disliked about the Trump movement, is that they think that, you know, it's kind of just based in a feeling, you know, of people wanting to make the, you know, America great again, but they don't really know anything and they don't really actually have any plan or any real knowledge of what that would even look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is somewhat of a fair criticism of the Trump movement. And I think that Trump he's got good instinct. And I think he has a compelling character. He's definitely a compelling force. But
what do you think about DeSantis?
Well, everyone knows DeSantis is just, you know, the Bush 2.0. This is another
mm-hmm,
Bush.
Okay.
So, I mean, Bush was the guy who put LaRouche in jail. So, you know, the Lyndon LaRouche movement, a lot of people don't know this, who are like starting to know about the LaRouche movement. Funnily enough, and I very much find this to be kind of off-putting, is they did support both Bill Clinton, and even they were kind of fans of Hillary Clinton versus Obama, which is a really weird thing that a lot of people don't know about. But they've LaRouche ran as a Democrat. He considered himself to be an FDR Democrat.
Yeah.
And they were big fans of JFK, which I could understand. And they hate Newt Gingrich. And during the early 2000s, they were really just a very anti-Bush, extremely anti-Bush. They labeled Bush and the whole regime as the children of Satan. And it's kind of interesting seeing how they've kind of gone back and forth. But I think it's because they've always kind of had some general principles that they've kind of clung on to,
mm-hmm.
you know?
All right, so who do you think's winning in 2024? If you had to take a guess right now, do you think Trump has any chance of being reelected?
Well, here's the thing. I think Trump, if there was no cheating that was going to happen, or if there was no, constitutional crisis that might result from this, I think Trump would win in an absolute landslide. I've never seen anything like the Trump movement. I've never seen anything like it. I remember there was one time during the 2020 election, I woke up and I look outside of my window, and this is in California, in a liberal area, in a liberal suburb of California, I wake up in the morning and there is just a line of trucks, all sorts of cars, a massive parade of trucks waving Trump flags, waving American flags, playing music, and they're just parading down the street for miles and miles and miles. And this went on for 3 hours. 3 hours, just bumper to bumper Trump cars, like slowly going down the street. This is in California. I mean, they must have had at least 10,000 people on this Trump train, or whatever they call it, Trump Brigade. I've never seen anything like it. And when you talk to real people, most of them either hate Trump or love Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that Trump is probably the most popular American president of all time, just as far as, I mean, I don't know. He's at least in my lifetime. I'm a young guy, but I've never seen the type of energy and the type of movement that you've seen around Trump. And I think that is really exciting, and it creates some really interesting political opportunities. But at the same time, it's, you know, we don't know if they're going to let him win, you know, and we don't know what that would result in if they just cheat again and Trump just agitates people. You know, who knows what's going to happen? I think that Trump will win if we have a fair election. But I think there's no telling what's going to happen, not to mention all the psyops they could run. They could run another type of J6. They could stir up all these kind of Black Lives Matter type Antifa protests. You know, frankly, you don't even, if Trump wins the election, what is going to be the react? Like, what is going to be the protest? Like, I don't see our democracy. The Democrats always love to say, oh, our democracy is under attack. They're like the biggest force, like making it kind of impossible to really have a functioning, secure democracy right now. And I don't know what's going to happen in 2024, bro. I don't know. But my hope is, and this is kind of the orientation I'm more leaning towards now, is I think that what Trump said with the quantum leap, and actually, if we could develop that idea further and we can make it ours, meaning the LaRouche movement, infrared, these people who come from this real pro-China, pro-Russia perspective, if we could carve out what a quantum leap would actually look like and what is the direction to that, and we can make that the libidinal, like people really feel that and know that and are excited for it, and they actually have a vision of a positive vision of America, not just a anti-liberal or anti-whatever, but an actual positive vision of what America could be. That's our best bet, but people are so nihilistic right now and so caught up in this kind of libidinal rage, even, see, I love this Rage Against the War Machine event, but I thought the name is stupid. You know, it's like, it's not about rage. We need harmony right now. But it needs to be real harmony, not some sort of fake imposed harmony. But we need healing, as cringe as it sounds. But
so, Liam, thank you for coming on. Where can people find you? And is there anyone you want to give a shout out to, including yourself?
Shouts out to God, man. Everything is in control. It's very exciting.
Patriots are in control? I thought we weren't on the...
Hey, I appreciate... I feel like I really rambled a lot in this, man, but...
Well, this is the place to do it, okay?
I appreciate it. It's been nice talking to you. People can follow me on Twitter, space2036. I hope that we could reach space by 2036. I hope we could reach fusion by 2036. People say that these are impossible goals, but if we don't even, like, it's true that what you set your mind to is what you can accomplish. If you don't think you could do something, you're not going to be able to do it.
Right.
So I hope that we could actually have a positive vision. And I think you're right to have fears about progress and about it not moving in the right direction. But that's where we need to take personal responsibility to try and really do whatever we can for both, so that we can look in the mirror and say, you know, everyone who came before me, my life was worth it. And everyone who comes after me, their lives are going to be better because of my sacrifice. And that's what drives me, is hoping that I could actually say that. So thanks for having me.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for coming on, man.